The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Pastor Mike, good afternoon. 7 minutes past 12. Man in Line live with David Ashford, MHK, between now and one. 74 new cases of COVID were identified yesterday. We now have 333 active cases on the island. Four people in Nobles, no one's in ICU. 285 people waiting for the result of a test, and 70 people booked in for a test today. From the vaccination dashboard, 65,473 first doses have been administered, 64,003 second doses, nine people booked in for the next 7 days, and DHSC holding 24,114 shots of vaccine in stock. David Ashford, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Andy.
Good to see you, and well, here we are again. It's an ongoing situation, and what's top of your priority list today?
Well, DHSC, we always have a very wide priority list. The priority list at the moment really has got to be trying to cut back on the backlog in elective surgery and trying to ensure that we can get some stabilisation across service provision.
OK, loads of people to get to. James is with us, first of all. Hi. Hello, James. You're live with David Ashford.
Hello, Mr. Ashford.
Hello, James.
I'm currently waiting for an orthopaedic operation on my knee. I've been off work for over 3 years now. I had an operation 2 years ago, but unfortunately it didn't work. So I've been transferred to Mr. Hutchinson, and he's got a planning in for me. But apparently, on the grapevine, you know what castle rumours are like, that there's no orthopaedic ops till after winter. Is this true, or?
Well, what we're doing at the moment, James, is it's not true. As far as I'm aware, there's none till after winter. We do have a specific problem around electives at the moment with the availability of anaesthetists, but Manx Care is working hard, particularly with our support networks in the UK, to try and overcome that. But Manx Care has also outlined a waiting list reduction plan, and orthopaedics forms part of that. So they're actually working with two UK-based external companies, Medifer and 18-week support, to basically buy in around about 2,500 consultations and procedures between now and March next year. So that will look to try and reduce down the orthopaedics waiting list. I've always been quite honest with it. The orthopaedics list is far too long. Mr. Hutchinson and the other specialists are trying to get through it as best they can. But obviously they have limited time, and we need to get support in place to bring it down, because it's not acceptable at the moment, the length of time people are waiting for orthopaedic surgery.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's sometimes you're in so much pain and you can't even sleep, or it's bit long.
What are you doing about the pain, James? What do you do about the pain?
I've got painkillers, but sometimes they just don't touch.
So hopefully this engagement by the two UK-based external operators, which will be coming over to the island, and also where it needs to be just virtual appointments to see people, hopefully will bring the waiting list down and will free up time to allow us to move forward with operations at a quicker rate. But like I say, we do have an issue at the moment with available anaesthetists. There has been impact in the last couple of weeks around the delivery of elective surgery, but we are trying to work with our providers in the northwest to see what we can do to try and alleviate that.
So, James, what was the last piece of paper you got from the department or from Manx Care to say? What did it actually say?
The last thing I got, I actually emailed Mr. Ashford, and Mr. Ashford put me through to Manx Care, and the email back saying I had an appointment with Mr. Hutchinson, which I've already seen Mr. Hutchinson, and now he's come up with this plan. But he told me that when I seen him, it would be about a month, maybe two now. He said that they haven't done any orthopaedic ops in 7 weeks. So, but now I've been hearing that it's longer than that now.
Yeah, there's been, like I said, there's been an impact over the last month or so, certainly about a month and a half, with the availability of anaesthetists. And that has impacted not just on orthopaedics, it's impacted across the whole of elective surgery due to the number of anaesthetists available. But we are, like I say, trying to work with our tertiary providers in the Northwest to try and alleviate that issue. Okay. But certainly there's not, as far as I'm certainly aware, unless Manx Care hasn't told me, any plans for a suspension of surgery through winter. Okay. That's certainly news to me.
All right, James, thanks for calling us today.
Thank you very much.
Jolly good. Specifically, what's the issue with anaesthetists?
I'm limited in what I can say, but it's to do with the availability of them at the moment. We have engaged with the Northwest to try and bring some over to the island. Unfortunately, they're struggling as well. There's a limit in availability of anaesthetists in the UK as well, but we are trying to work our way through that.
Okay. I mean, were we ever self-sufficient in anaesthetists here?
Yes, we were. It's something that's impacted really in the last month or so. So it is a very specific impact that Manx Care couldn't have predicted.
Okay. Here's Pam with us now. Hello, Pam.
Hello.
Hi, Pam.
Hello, Mr. Ashford.
Okay. What's your question, Pam?
Can I ask you if there's any clinics going to be open on the island or anything that can be done for those of us that are suffering with long COVID?
Yes, there is. There is plans in place with Manx Care to develop a service that will deal with ME and long COVID. They are going to be two separate services in one bubble because obviously what's required for ME and what's required for long COVID can be very, very different. But at the moment they are developing that service, which we hope to have up and running in some form early in the new financial year next year to try and help provide bespoke support for those who've still got issues.
Is this a problem you have, Pam?
And when I go to the doctor, I seem to be there more times than I'm at home lately. When I go, they say they've got no answer for me.
What are the symptoms that you have, Pam?
The symptoms that I have are joint pain, lethargic, foggy head, still got a cough, no energy, out of breath and dizziness.
Yeah, and that's what this clinic will try to look to address, to try and provide a bespoke service where people can be referred on to different specialist areas. One of the issues with long COVID is the symptoms are different for different people. So some people just lose their taste and smell. Others have it for a short specified period of time. And for others, it's long-term effects. So it's important as we develop this service that they've got the ability to refer into other services because it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all.
And when did you have COVID, Pam?
I had it in March.
Okay. How bad was it at the time?
I was very bad for 5 weeks.
And in terms of percentage then, how far do you think you're back to being 100%?
Oh, I don't know how long that's going to take me to get back to 100%. I have good days. I have bad days. Good days, I can get up and I can do my housework and go out for a walk. Bad days, all I want to do is sit and lie on the sofa and do nothing.
Okay. So have we bottomed out exactly what causes this?
I mean, it can be different with long COVID. Like I say, there's a range of symptoms different people experience. It's from the low end where some people may have a continuous cough or breathing difficulties for a few weeks afterwards to what Pama seems to be experiencing, which is long-term effects about 6 months on. COVID attacks the lungs, so breathing difficulties and being lethargic are actually some of the more common symptoms of long COVID. But there are others as well, and that's why we need to, with this service that's being developed in Manx Care, make sure it can refer into a range of other services because different people will require different things.
Pam, were you vaccinated?
I wasn't vaccinated. I was due to get my vaccination, strangely enough, a week before I got the COVID. So I didn't actually get my vaccinations.
Okay.
We went into lockdown and that was it. I got the COVID along with a good few of my friends all at the same time.
Okay. Well, Pam, we wish you all the best. Thanks for calling.
Lovely. Thank you very much. And thank you, David.
Okay. Thanks, Pam.
Okay. And here's Stephen with us now. Hello, Stephen. You're live with David Ashford.
Oh, good afternoon, Minister, and good afternoon,
Hi, Stephen.
David, I... you probably guessed what I want to speak about, which is the... Well, sadly, we were unable to save the Corran Memorial Home in Peel for residential care. And I wondered, have you been able to make any progress talking to the trustees of that site? Because I'm sure you would agree that site is probably one of the best that could be found within the community for Peel for a residential care home. So I wonder, A, firstly, have you made any progress on that? And second question would be, I think Bill Henderson introduced an amendment to the motion where there was a report to be made about the lack of residential care in the West and other associated requirements to be to report back in October. I wonder, is that still on track? And how will it be progressed if you no longer are minister in the new... in the new Comin?
Well, there are lots of questions in there. I'll take them one by one, Stephen. I'm happy to say we have engaged with the trustees. I know the department has met with them in the last month, or within the last 4 weeks, and we are continuing talks. My view has always been the same, which is that is a very strategic piece of land there in the west of the island, and it's important to our commitment to retain care in the west of the island. So I said at the time of the Timbald resolution, which I fully supported, that we needed to actually engage with the trustees and try and see what we could do around that piece of land. The trustees have been engaging with us and talks are ongoing in that regard. In terms of the motion, we're not going to be able to get back to October Timbald with that full report because the talks are still ongoing with the trustees. So I have written to members of the new House of Keys and wider Timbald Legislative Council as well to actually say that it's the report's likely to be later than October now because we need to obviously know where we stand with that piece of land and how everything fits together. And in terms of wherever I may be in a week's time, you know, ministers are, being blunt, politicians and ministers come and go, but the strategic direction has been set. All members of Timbald supported that resolution. So I would suspect that unless I'm going to be replaced as Minister for Health and Social Care by a brand new member of the House of Keys, I would suspect that whoever takes over from me is equally as committed as I am to actually ensure that we continue with providing appropriate care in the West and that that site has a long-term sustainable future.
That's jolly good news to hear.
Okay, thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today. Just a note in from Alice, just to underline this long COVID and ME service. Do you know when it'll start?
So well, there's certain things we'll be able to do in the early in the new year, but the main part of the financing we hope to come online in the start of the next financial year. So it would probably be the new financial year before the service is properly up and running.
Okay, a message in from Joe just said, could you ask the Minister if social care benefits will be increased due to the rise in the cost of living, as they're already below the poverty line and don't cover the lowest of basic living costs as they stand? How is this going to progress?
So it depends what's meant by social care benefits, Andy. If it's meant about the individual allowances within nursing homes and so on, we look to uprate those each year, and that has the order for that went through Timbald, the last Timbald, I think, in July. If it's the wider benefits piece, a lot of people make the mistake that it sits with DHSC. It doesn't. General benefits sit within Treasury. It's not within social care, and again, Treasury looks at that on an annual basis, so that will be looked at as part of the budget process in February.
Could you explain the testing, PCR testing, says this is Southern Andy. I'm confused as to why on COVID PCR testing there's always about 250 to 300 results pending each day, yet there are only approximately 100 tests per day booked. I was aware at one point testing capacity was about 800 a day. Surely having precise, fast data is a critical indicator of contagion on the Isle of Man. So is the testing delayed?
No, what's happened, we've got to remember all the snapshots like you just gave before when we came into the programme, Andy, are literally that, they're snapshots in time. So the number of tests booked is up to that point. As the day goes on, more and more tests will continue to be booked into the system. That obviously will not be reported until the next snapshot, and the test may have taken place by then, so you can't necessarily correlate because we don't publish figures like that in real time. They are snapshot figures.
Okay. This is Alec just saying, why aren't we insisting on a negative flow test to be produced at the ports before people are being allowed to travel to the Isle of Man? Other countries are doing this. The less COVID we have coming here can only help to reduce cases. It would save another incident like the one last week where the coach load of passengers had to isolate in their hospital, in their hotel.
Well, it's quite an interesting one, this, Andy. I mean, as we come to live with COVID, there's various things that we need to consider. In relation to vaccination, the science and the reports is still showing that if you're double vaccinated, you have a 50% less likelihood of catching COVID in the first place, and on top of that, a 50% reduction in transmission. So an overall transmission reduction of 75%. But there's also science starting to emerge in some reports that shows that if you test double vaccinated people, the vaccine does what it's supposed to do. It actually basically reduces the effects of the virus, and that unless you catch people who are double vaccinated at the peak of their infection, so normally around about day 4 or 5 after infection, then actually they'll pass a test because the level of virus in their system may not be high enough, even although they're carrying it. So testing double vaccinated people doesn't necessarily give you the assurance that you want unless you hit them at the peak time of their infection.
You've been living and breathing this flipping thing now since March of last year. So you must know the trajectory the Isle of Man is on. You confident, optimistic?
I am. My crystal ball is as foggy as anyone else's. But I do think we're taking the right moves now. We're trying to relax as much as we can while trying to maintain safety as well. And we do have to come to that difficult balance of living with COVID. As I said on the last time I appeared on the programme here, you know, there's going to be bumps along the road. It's not going to be, it's not an easy task. No one's ever really had to do this in a modern world. And the last time was the Spanish flu pandemic, and that was over 100 years ago. So it's not going to be an easy process, but we need to come to terms with operating as a society. And having been out and spoken to people on the doorstep over the election campaign, I've got to say that is the view of most people out there, or certainly the people I've spoken to anyway, that they feel a lot more comfortable now of living with COVID. It's about personal responsibility and people taking the precautions that are right for them.
How many doors did you knock?
I didn't get round the whole constituency in the end. My job as minister unfortunately carried on. In the end, I got round 1,983.
How much was COVID a subject when you knocked on the door and they said, "Oh, Mr. Rashford, I'd like to talk to you about"?
I'll be honest, it didn't actually come up that much. Not as much as I expected, actually, to be honest, particularly with being Minister for Health as well. It didn't really feature. What most people wanted to speak about was where things are going in the next 5 years, not just COVID, but in general, and what the direction of travel is for the island. People didn't seem to have this fascination of what had gone on the last 2 years. It was very forward looking and saying we are where we are now, but what's going to happen over the next 5 years?
A question from Joan, who just says, how bad do you think the flu is going to be this September? You asked about your crystal ball.
Well, there's been mixed reports. There's public health certainly in bigger jurisdictions like the UK that say there's going to be a wave of flu. I know public health here has been warning. We'll take precautions as we always do because we want to make sure that the health service isn't overwhelmed. But equally, there's some scientists who are coming out and saying actually they don't think it's going to be as bad as predicted. But it's important that that's why we have our pandemic reports and also our winter flu plans within DHSC and Manx Care. And we'll be activating those to make sure that we can cope.
25 past 12. Alice is with us now. Hi, Alice.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, you're on with David Ashford.
Hello, Alice.
Hiya, David. I was just wondering what the specific reason is for the delay in the long COVID service, because I know Manx Care have had a plan for the service for like several months now, and I was told it went to Treasury for funding approval like a month or two or more ago. So is it just that Treasury are refusing to fund it until after April?
The bid that went in, like I say, there is some money in the pot for this financial year, but it is unusual for funding to be done into year because it disrupts the budget. So the main funding that was applied for was for the full financial year next year. Yeah. But there is an existing pot of money that was there for the development of the ME service, which, like I say, it's going to be a joint service, although they're two different things.
Yeah.
So that money will be used between now and April. But we have to remember, go out for recruitment. We have to get the recruitment on board because we need people to deliver this service.
Doctor training would be really good because a lot of people saying they're talking to doctors and they still don't know what long
COVID is. And one of the things that will be part of that is obviously training for the GPs and those at primary care level because, like you say, it's important they're engaged and they understand the signs, but equally they've got somewhere to refer into. Yeah. So I'll be frank, it's unfortunate.
Also hospital doctors, people encountering hospital doctors who don't know what it is.
Yeah. But like I say, unfortunately, it's one of those things where, you know, as much as I'd love it to be up and running overnight, it's going to take time to recruit to get the services in place.
How widespread is it?
Actually, we're seeing roughly around what they've seen in the UK, from my understanding, which is roughly that you're seeing around about between 2-3%.
So that will be how cases. Many on the island?
So I'm just trying to work out how many cases we've actually had, Andy, in total. I can't remember off the top of my head now. But you'll probably be looking at about 150 people, 150 to 200 people, I would say.
Can I just say something? We've got like a couple of hundred people just on our Facebook page, and there's another Facebook page with a couple of hundred people, and we haven't been advertising it in the last few months. So I think looking at the Office of National Statistics, it was more like 10-15% that they were looking at. They did a survey back in, I think it was March, and they had a million people, you know.
Just a minute, Alice, let's just say, so on your Facebook, are these 200 people who are just following the Facebook page or 200 people who've been diagnosed?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people who don't know about the page, right? There's a lot of people, most of them have got symptoms. There's a few people with ME who are there just because they're interested, but most of the people there have got long COVID symptoms.
Yeah, just to say, though, with the Office of National Statistics, which you quoted there, the definition from the report of Office of National Statistics is any ongoing symptom after COVID has been recovered from. So they don't specify a period of time. If you drill into the report that the ONS did, where they broke it down by basically how long people experience the symptoms, the amounts drop down. So once you got about 12 weeks after, which is where they stopped their report,
it was about 6% had sort of disabling fatigue, you know, so they couldn't go back to normal activity.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
But it declined over the 12-week period. So when I'm referring to long COVID, I'm talking about those who have it past the 12-week period.
All right, Alice, thanks for calling us today. We've got to dash on because there are loads of people waiting for questions. We appreciate your call. Thanks, Alice. Ken's with us now. Hello, Ken. You're live with David Ashford.
Afternoon, Minister. I'd like to know, it would be helpful if when, like, the 75 new cases of COVID, that there would be some age range, because most people thinking the school kids are getting infected. And two, how much did the new Manx Care Bunch cost to set up, and is it really going to save money?
So in terms of first of all the age ranges, they are done on the website. So if you actually go on to the breakdown, there is a slide that actually breaks all of the age ranges out across all the cases. So people can see where the age ranges are spiking in terms of cases. We won't break it down on a daily basis because again, when we've got low numbers, it may be people within individual age ranges. So you might be talking 1, 2, or 3, and that would class. I've been told as individual identifying information, but you can actually work it out from the dashboard where it's coming through on the age ranges. I think it's slide 5 or 6, I think, on the dashboard. But in terms of Manx Care, the setup costs were around about 3 million off the top of my head. And actually, there is a saving target built in of 2% to Manx Care's budgets this year. And longer term, yes, the plan is that they will save money. There's some areas where they are already starting to realise savings. But we were realistic about it and we said that it would take a good 12 months, 18 months for people to be able to see the effects of Manx Care. So it'll be in the next financial year when people will be able to see. And there is actually key performance indicators around finance in Manx Care's plan.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Good to hear from you. Ian's with us now. Hello, Ian. You're live with David Ashford.
Yes, just following along with that for a previous caller. I was listening to the chief exec of Manx Care on Manx Radio a number of weeks ago, and one of her key performance indicators was to stay within budget for Manx Care. By implication, does this mean there'll be no supplementary votes required for the departments?
Well, that, by implication, yes. We actually didn't have a supplementary vote last year. The department came within the budget that was allocated. So last year was the first year, I think, in probably about five or six years, actually, that the department hadn't had to come back for a supplementary vote, but there wasn't one in the last financial year either. But that is one of the key performance indicators amongst care to keep within the budget allocated.
Right, thank you very much, Minister. Thank you. Very candid answer.
Okay, good to hear from you. Thanks, Ian. And this is Anne's dropped a note in to David Ashford saying, is there any data on childhood dental health and what's the cost of the Manx Health Service of childhood extractions and any chance of reopening the fluoride debate? In 1947, the Medical Office of Health pleaded for fluoride to be added to the Isle of Man's water supply using special toothpaste, and is apparently no substitute.
Well, in terms of the dental, I don't have those figures with me. I'm probably sure Public Health does actually have those figures, but I can't answer that, Andy, because that's not one I can do just off the top of my head, unfortunately. In terms of the fluoride and the water supply, if I remember rightly, I think there was a consultation on this. I lose track of time now, but probably about 10 years ago, I think. And I don't think there was support for it. You know,
2014, Health Minister Howard Quayle.
Oh, well, there we are. So
says,
7 years ago, so a lot.
His department has no plans to fluoridate the island's water supply.
Yeah, and I think there was actually consultation prior to that, I think. At the moment, there are no plans to do so. We take advice from Public Health in relation to this. And obviously, you know, if it was advised, then we would have to undertake a public consultation on that and then would seek approval from Timbal to do so. But certainly at the moment, echoing that what's been said in 2014, there is no at the moment plans to change that. Fluoride's never been added to the drinking water in the Isle of Man, as far as I'm aware. There
and
is
that
some
would
naturally
be a
occurring.
That would be a policy decision.
It would be a policy decision, and it would require full public consultation before we went down that route.
Okay, and thanks for that. And by the way, I did to find out that was put in fluoride into the Manx Radio search engine on the page, and up it pops Howard Quayle in 2014. Quintin Gill, Russian MHK, in 2008 was keen to revive the fluoride issue as well. So if you ever want to find out through the Manx Radio News Archive, just go to the news page and there's a search engine there. Just put whatever you want in and you never know what's coming out. David Ashford, MHK, live with us on Man in Line today through till 1. If you want to put a question to David Ashford, text on 166177, email studio@manxradio.com, or call the minister on 66 13 68.
This is the Isle of Man talking. The Man in Line.
Coming up on your left is TD Car Centre. TD Car Centre, for a great selection of top-of-the-range used cars available. All sourced and looked after by exceptional island mechanics. You have driven past TD Car Centre. Make a U-turn where possible and proceed to Hills Meadow. I said, make a U-turn where possible. You're due an upgrade. TD Car Centre. tdcar.in.
Choose Milan Vets for your farm animal care. Expert services include export examinations, routine and post-import blood sampling, along with ultrasound scanning and fertility work. Milan Vets also offer herd health plans for farm assurance. Farmers can also order in advance to receive discounted medications. Visit online at milanvets.co.uk or call today on 674 532. Milan Veterinary Practice, caring for all creatures, great and small.
At the Buchan School, we provide the perfect start to a child's education with exceptional pastoral care, average class sizes of 14, specialist subject teaching, a wide and varied extracurricular programme, and before and after school clubs, all in idyllic surroundings with a dedicated minibus service. Come to our open morning on Saturday the 9th of October at 10 a.m. Take a tour, talk to pupils and staff, and find out more about our happy and lively school. Call 820-110 for details.
Man Benham brings you the Isle of Man e-gaming seminar at the Villa Marina on the 12th of October. Come along and listen to the experts talking about the latest innovations and hot topics. Something for all businesses, not just the e-gaming sector. You can catch up with our sponsors, Champion Sports, Capital International Bank, Continent 8, Much Better and Man Benham, along with the speakers during the break and networking lunch. To find out more or book online, visit iomegs.online.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
24 minutes to 1. Mike is with us now. You're live with David Ashford, MHK. Mike?
I'd like to ask the minister why he stripped Ramsey Cottage Hospital everything that the League of Friends bought and put into Nobles, and why they have been, for the last 10 years, running Ramsey Cottage Hospital into the ground and trying to do away with it.
Well, in terms of Ramsey Cottage Hospital, during my time as minister, I'm not aware of anything being transferred out of Ramsey into Nobles. Prior to my time as minister, I believe the endoscopy went over. I was on the Social Affairs Policy Review Committee, and that actually held an inquiry into that at the time. But during my ministerial time, we've tried to enhance Ramsey Cottage Hospital. We've kept in place the early sense detection system that the League of Friends actually paid for and has provided within the hospital. We've kept the minor injuries unit going. As far as I'm concerned, Ramsey Cottage Hospital is a jewel in the health services crown.
Well, all that doctor equipment was bought by the Ramsey League of Friends, and you took it away from there and put it up to Nobles.
Well, I didn't. It was actually prior to my time as minister, and as I say, I was a backbencher at the time, and I actually opposed the move.
There's lots of stuff the League of Friends has bought and has been transferred to Nobles.
Not during the last 4 years. I can't think of anything during my time as minister.
Well, I'm thinking over the last 10 years I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can only talk for what I'm responsible for, and certainly during my 4 years as minister, we've tried to enhance the service provision at Ramsey. I see it as a jewel in the crown of the health service, and like I say, the endoscopy, the thing that changed, which was, I think, 2016 or early 2017, which was under my predecessor as minister. I was on the Social Affairs Policy Review Committee at the time that held an inquiry into that, and I actually put questions down in Tim Ward about the move.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for that call. But just going on with Ramsey Cottage Hospital, David Ashford, there always seems to be a rumbling undercurrent that the department would love to get rid of Ramsey Cottage Hospital and centralise everything.
No, well, I certainly think that's certainly not been the case over certainly my time as minister. If it's been there before...
The patients seem to love Ramsey Cottage Hospital.
I think Ramsey Cottage Hospital, as I say, is a jewel in the crown. I certainly don't think it should go under any circumstances. I think there's lots of things that can be done with it to enhance health services and provision. Because we have to remember, Ramsey Cottage Hospital isn't just there for the north of the island, it's there for the whole of the island. The minor injuries unit up there is open to anyone, and we should be utilising more of Ramsey.
Just a question now about the A&E service at Nobles. There's a lady who's had some just anecdotal evidence. She knows people, everybody knows everybody on the Isle of Man, but she knows of three people who report about the decline in the service at A&E. One person was in there for internal bleeding following leg surgery and actually left and went home after not being seen for 5 hours. A friend who was sitting there with a child who's post-COVID and fitting and shaking was there for 2 hours with no attention, not even triaged. And a lady went in after a fall, was left in A&E for over 4 hours, not even given a glass of water.
Well, if any of those cases are correct, then that's completely unacceptable, to be perfectly frank, in terms of service provision. And people need to be complaining about this. They need to actually flag it up as a formal complaint via Manx Care to ensure that that can be properly investigated.
Is there an issue at A&E?
Not to my knowledge. A&E times have been continuing as normal. We did have, obviously, during the peak of hospital admissions, problems and pressures on A&E, where we were asking people who only had minor injuries to go up to Ramsey and utilise that. And that's another benefit of Ramsey Minor Injuries Unit, actually, while we're mixing the two topics up, that it does give that ability for capacity. But if those issues have occurred, then people need to formally complain.
So they can complain
via the patient safety team. All the contact details are on the website for those, both email and telephone number, and they should make a formal complaint, and that way it can be formally investigated, and if there needs to be changes to procedures, that will come off the back of it.
Anne in Mackled said, I'd like to congratulate MCALS for being an efficient service. I contacted MCALS with a query and they were able to help immediately, which put my mind at rest. I previously contacted other departments within the hospital and didn't even get a response. So thanks to I don't know what MCALS is. What is it?
So MCALS is the Manx Care Advice and Liaison Service. So it's the ability for people who are maybe looking for certain set advice or actually trying to actually give feedback about something they've had, to be able to contact that service and feedback or seek the advice that they need. MCALS can be contacted on 642 642. or via mcowls@gov.im. I'm delighted to hear that the service worked so well.
So just run through that again. What sort of query or problem would you have to contact mcowls?
So it's about patients feeding back user experiences, to try and sort out problems and providing advice to people. So people might be saying, well, I've got this issue, I don't know where to go, and mcowls will try and direct them to the right area. So what mcowls can't do, which is probably something very important to lay out, is they can't provide medical advice or diagnosis or counselling or a formal complaint resolution. They need to go through the general process, but for general queries or where people are wanting to try and get information, they can contact mcowls, and the number is 642 642.
That's great. Thanks, Anne. And Juan's with us. Juan, you're live with David Ashford.
Good afternoon, Andy. Afternoon, David.
Good afternoon.
Congratulations on getting back in. I hope, like you say, the people voted with their feet this time round. I hope that on this time that Comyn is less secretive as what they were last time and actually shares some more information with the backbenchers. Just going on quickly, there's a lot of stuff that I could talk about. I'm not going to get time. Looking at the figures now that's coming out of the UK, they're saying 63% now of death rates is from fully vaccinated people. Interested to see this week information coming from the US on a new drug called molnupiravir, I think it is. Interesting to see that the their specialist, Dr. Fauci, is saying that it's progressing very well. And it's produced by Merck, a company called Merck, which actually has got a license to produce ivermectin. So I find that very interesting that this drug is being produced there. And I hope the government will look into that. Because going on from that a little bit, what's your take on vaccine passports, David?
So, well, it depends what you mean by vaccine passports. If you mean internally, so use for things for entry to events, entry to, say, pubs and clubs, I've never been in favour of that. I don't agree internally we should be using vaccine passports. In terms of vaccine passports for travel, obviously in terms of the residence pathway, if you've stayed within the CTA, whether you're vaccinated or unvaccinated now, you can actually travel freely. In terms of international travel, I mean, other countries will make other decisions around what they require, and we can't dictate to other countries what they do, but we've certainly relaxed in terms of our requirements between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals if they're remaining within the CTA. And certainly, like I say, internally within Ireland, the island, I wouldn't support using them for entry to clubs, pubs and everything like that. In terms of, just to say though, you mentioned at the start about the death rate from double vaccinated individuals, you would expect that because 90% of the adult population, both here and in the UK, are now double vaccinated. So in theory, if they were representative of the population, you would actually expect 9 in every 10 deaths or hospital admissions to be people who had fully vaccinated. It's not the case. As you said, in the UK, it's about 60-odd percent. So actually, those who are unvaccinated are actually making up, both in terms of deaths and hospital admissions, a higher percentage than they are as a percentage of the population.
Obviously, there's a lot of facts and figures. I'm taking it from the GOP lawmakers' legislation that's coming from America this week. So it's obviously, we haven't got time to go into different facts and figures. I just bounced that one off you there. Well, the question I did want to ask before Andy cuts me off, where do you see the island in 10 years? There's obviously a lot of things that's going on within the world at the moment, and that there is distinct changes which is being veiled under different things. I want to know where you stand as a newly elected MHK going in. Has the Alamann government, how much teeth it's got to stand alone away from international agendas that's going on and do the best for the island as the island stand alone, rather than taking on massive agendas like I've just mentioned, the vaccine passport and a lot of other stuff, which I'm sure you know what's going on in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to reply. I'll try and keep it brief as well before Andy cuts me off. But in relation to the direction of travel, I think, you know, it's very hard to predict 10 years into the future because the world changes so radically. But over the next 5 years, I think as an island, we've got got a huge opportunity to remodel the island as somewhere, a base for research and development, a base for climate change technology to be developed. In terms of the international agenda, I don't think we can become isolationist. It's impossible to isolate the island away from things that are going on, such as the, for instance, corporate tax compliance that's becoming an international obligation, MoneyVal, etc. We can't isolate ourselves away from that, and we have to actually work with those challenges. But I think we do have a huge opportunity to rebase how our economy operates for the benefit of the people of the island. And like I say, that evolves around being a front runners in green technology. We've got wind and sea, tidal patterns. We should be using that. And also, I think we lend ourselves to research and development becoming a big industry here on the island as well.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Juan. Just quickly then, how do you feel about this gas field off Mackold?
In terms of the gas field off Mackold, I think, you know, I think what we need to do is we need to check what, you know, if there is value to actually extracting the gas, then I would be supportive. In terms of the fact that we do what Norway did, and we actually feed the money back into green technology.
Right.
So Norway actually has funded, has become one of the most self-sustaining economies in terms of green technology. They actually used the money from their gas fields and their energy fields to actually pump prime that funding.
Yes.
Because to try and do climate change is going to cost tens of millions of pounds. Just to correct something that did come out of the election campaign and made a headline about the value of the gas.
It's not 800 billion.
No, it's not. I think if we had that much gas beneath us, in terms of what that works out as per square metre, several trillion square metres, I think you'd be scared to strike a match, to be perfectly honest, on the island. But no, so it's nowhere near that value.
Go on.
But like I say, if there is a value that of amount of money that can come back in and it can actually prove beneficial to actually advancing our green agenda, then I would actually be supportive.
Oh, I see. So we could use gas extract and the money from that to actually to transition to green.
Yes,
energy.
And that's exactly what Norway's done.
I see. Did you hear what one of the middle MHKs said about the Manx Health Service?
If you mean the comments by a former colleague of yours, I did indeed, Andy.
Now, apparently he picked this up on the doorstep. A former UK NHS worker said the Manx Health Service will be in special measures. What was that about?
Well, we need to be clear what special measures is in the UK, because a lot of people get confused. Special measures is actually where they find there is an actual failing to deliver and they send in turnaround teams in the CQC. I've not seen anything that would suggest Nobles, if it was in the UK regime, would be in special measures. But I think one of the important things to put into context is our health service is subject to scrutiny. So we have scrutiny by the Royal Colleges. We've brought in external agencies previously, including the West Midlands Quality Review Service. And also we're now engaging with CQC themselves to come over and hopefully start an inspection regime next year in 2022. And Manx, the whole point of creating Manx Care was to create a distinct service delivery body at the arm's length from policymakers. And we have actually seen via Manx Care already some structural changes to the service and that focus on service delivery. There's clear targets within Manx Care. There's an outcomes framework which anyone can go online and pick up, including elected members, that will actually show them the targets for Manx Care have to meet over the next year. But certainly I've not seen anything that would suggest that we would, if we were in the UK, be in special measures.
What were the issues with the operating theatres?
So it depends. So which particular issues, I suppose?
They said that broadly everything was fine with, but there were some issues with
operating. Right. This was the efficiency report. Yes. That actually came in about the most efficient way to use the operating theatres. That has actually been engaged with. We're bringing on a contractor who's been coming in to actually offer advice and support. So that wasn't around any safety issues or anything else. It was purely down to the way we use our operating theatres.
10 to 1 on Manx Radio with David Ashford, MHK, Minister for Health and Social Care. We haven't even talked about the Chief Minister or where Mr. Ashford could be this time next week.
Office World at Spring Valley is the island's largest one-stop shop for packaging materials. We stock everything from huge rolls of bubble wrap to single envelopes, padded bags, mailing tubes, labels, packaging tape, storage boxes, and much more. Office World has everything you need to package your goods safely and securely. Office World is also home to the island's largest stationery store, with over 4,000 products under one roof, with free parking right outside the front door. It has to be Office World at Spring Valley Estate, Braddon.
Dine in at Pizzeria at Pizza Napoli Douglas. Open with a fully licensed bar and a wide range of new food offerings, including pasta, arancini starters, burgers, and of course, pizza. Order a full pizza or just buy the slice and check out our desserts menu. Dine in for an evening meal Tuesdays to Sundays. Call to book on 813 100. That's 813 100 or online at pizzanapoli.im. Pizza Napoli.
You're sure to find something fabulous at Ramsey Art Gallery, Jewellers and Engravers.
From stunning gold and silver jewellery that you can make extra special with an engraved message, to local prints and gifts for every occasion, Ramsey Art Gallery also stock a fantastic range of watches, including Ted Baker, Citizen, Storm and Accurist.
Plus Zaconda, Timex, Sexy and Bulova.
All with lifelong free strap adjustment. You'll love what you find in store when you visit Ramsey Art Gallery, Jewellers and Engravers, opposite the RNLI shop in Ramsey.
Coming up, we've got another winning weekend on Manx Radio, and this time we're teaming up with Tell Skips to give you the chance to win a £150 voucher to spend at Barbary Coast in Douglas. To win, all you need to do is take part in our winning weekend wordplay, which is on all day Saturday and Sunday. Get your name in the draw and we'll announce the winner on Monday's breakfast show at 10 to 9. So join us this weekend to be a winner with Tell Skips here on your nation station, Manx Radio.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
8 minutes before one, David Ashford is with us. And Ivor, you're live with the Minister.
Oh, hello, Andy. Good afternoon, Minister.
Good afternoon.
Just a brief query regarding cataract attention. What's the present position, please, regarding the service for dealing with cataracts? I believe some time ago there was mentioned about specialists being brought from across.
Yeah, that's correct. It ties in with what we were discussing at the start of this programme when I mentioned about companies being brought over. The company I mentioned, 18-week support, they have consultant surgeons, nurses and theatre practitioners that will be travelling over to the island to deliver 2,500 endoscopy and cataract procedures at Nobles Hospital. So that will start occurring from the end of this month through to March. So it will bring the waiting list massively down because cataracts, again, is one of those things where the list has built up over a good period of time.
Right. Well, I'm very grateful for that information. Thank you very much for letting me know.
OK, thank you. And David Ashford, next Tuesday it's all going to happen. There'll be a new Chief Minister, Dr. Allinson or Mr. Cannon. Who would you prefer?
Well, I'm backing Alf Cannon. I've seen Alf's vision. He shared with me his vision as to where he believes the island needs to go over the next 5 years. It's a vision I can buy into and one I'm exceptionally excited about, so I'll be backing Mr. Cannon.
Well, this coming Sunday, they'll both be live on Manx Radio from 12 through to 1 just to chat through what they do. Is this based on Mr. Cannon's previous experience in Treasury and the experience that he's got?
For me, it's about vision and where the island's going to go. I said during the election campaign, what was key to me is people buying into the fact that we've got huge social change that needs to happen over the next five years and what can happen domestically. I believe his experience plays a massive part in that. He's been at Treasury doing a tough 5 years, but having seen his vision and he's engaged with me over that vision, it's a vision I can support.
Do you think this time next week you'll still be at DHSSE?
Well, again, you know, the crystal ball is not just foggy. I think it's cracked in that regard. Nobody knows where they'll be in a week's time in terms of ministers. Mm. It'll be entirely at the behest of whoever becomes the new chief minister, who they want where.
I just want to pick you up on what you said when you were trogging around Willesden and Tramode, when you were going around there, and you said that you intimated that people aren't so much bothered about the past, more with the future.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the feedback. And don't forget Governors Hill and Glencrutchie. It's also part of the constituency. People were wanting to know things about affordable housing, about the direction of travel for the island. People were really future focused when I spoke on the doorstep.
Interesting. Now, you're back in for another 5 years. Personally, do you have any ambitions that you want to tick?
Well, obviously, my ambition is to move the island forward, to actually see, as I laid out in my manifesto, changes to affordable housing. I think there's things that need to be done around the planning system, around the benefits system. So my five-year plan was laid out in my quite extensive manifesto, and that's what I'll be fighting for.
Are you happy with the upgrade at Willesden?
The refurbishment has been mixed. There's some people who've had some very good experiences, and there's others that have had absolutely horrendous experiences. And myself and John Wunnenberg, the other new member for Douglas North, will be working closely with the council in terms of feedback and ensuring that things work as smoothly as possible.
Do you think it's time for some more public sector housing to be built?
Well, that's one of the things that's in my manifesto, that when we talk about affordable housing, we've got to look at the whole piece. So not just first-time buyers has become the mantra, but also retirement housing, the mid-price housing, and also that includes social housing as well. I think the last social housing review, which I said in our debate in Douglas North, as far as I'm aware, was the 1980s, the last first fundamental one.
David Ashford, MHK, has been with us on Man in Line today. As usual, it's flown by. Thanks for being with us today. Good to talk to you. The debate on Sunday is from 12 till 1. Dr. Allinson, Mr. Cannon will be live on Manx Radio and also streaming on Facebook and YouTube as well. Back tomorrow, open line on 66 13 68. Any follow-ups you want, by the way, all you need to do is drop a note to maninline@manxradio.com or call the answer phone on 682 631. Thanks for calling today. Thanks for the messages and texts. And thanks to Howie Kane producing on Man in Line. I'm Andy Wint. Back tomorrow at 12 midday. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday.